Is the court ready to hear argument in Chavot versus State? Are you ready to proceed? Very well.
May it please the court.
Justice Holland, Justice Berger, Justice Risley. Good morning to you all. My name is Robert Goff. I represent the appellate John Chavis, is how I pronounce his name. I apologize if it's not correct, because I may in fact be incorrect. I just don't remember.
We'll go with your pronunciation.
Okay. Your Honor, this case comes to the court as the result of both a trial and of a plea. There's been normal briefing, standard briefing on the matter, and there's also been a request and also filing of supplemental memorandum to this court asking us to discuss the impact of the recent case of Scarborough versus State of this honorable court. The issue on appeal, as I see it, Your Honor, is whether my client, the appellant John Chavis, should be granted his request to withdraw his guilty plea and go to trial on the robbery case against him. This case, as was mentioned in my opponent's brief, opposing counsel's brief, does implicate some issues with regard to pro se versus hybrid versus represented clients, and it's relevant to mention them here. This particular defendant, John Chavis, wanted to withdraw his guilty plea before the sentencing hearing on December 1st, 2006. He had written a letter to that effect. That letter did come into my possession prior to that date. However, at that time, I regarded it as a letter and also without any legal basis to file a motion on my own, and perceived my duties to the court as being not to file frivolous motions. As a result, we went to the sentencing hearing, and at that hearing, the issue came up. At sentencing, as Your Honor noted, when the prosecutor became aware of Mr. Chavis's desire to withdraw the guilty plea, the prosecutor at that time indicated, after consultation with counsel, with myself, that he was going to make a recommendation other than what was in the written plea agreement. The written plea agreement, as Your Honors know, contained a recommendation of minimum mandatory time with regard to the charge he had pled guilty to, and also the minimum sentence as to the charge he had been convicted at his earlier trial.
Do you agree that we should be analyzing this issue involving any breach of a plea agreement under contract principles?
I do, Your Honor.
So is your client's pro se motion to withdraw the guilty plea, was that a breach of the plea agreement?
I do not think so, and here's why. The plea agreement involved essentially two pieces from the parties, from the state and from the defense. One piece was my client's decision or act of pleading guilty, legal act of pleading guilty before the court. The second part of the plea agreement in this was the state's recommendation of what sentence he would receive. The third part was not part of the parties, but takes it out of the usual realm of contracts, and is the judge's imposition of sentence, whatever that might be.
But if we're going to stay with the contract analogy, mm-hmm. even though on that particular sentencing day a greater sentence was imposed later, that was withdrawn and corrected, and ultimately your client got the sentence that had been bargained for. So the question is, didn't your client get the benefit of any bargain that he had obtained?
In that sense, yes, Your Honor. And I think I acknowledge in my answering memorandum that the issue, what I perceive to be the significant issue on appeal, and the only real bone of contention which has any real meat to it, is the question of remedy before the court. If this court finds that the remedy that was eventually imposed by the trial judge, and that is essentially a specific performance of the contract, was the right thing to do and not an abuse of discretion, then this matter should be affirmed on appeal. If, on the other hand, the court finds that the appropriate remedy is withdrawal of the plea, then that is what we're seeking in this case. I'm not sure if I answered your question, Your Honor.
Well, I understand your answer. I'm having trouble understanding the predicate for any type of relief, because in your introductory remarks, you said your client was represented at the time he filed the pro se motion.
Correct.
And therefore, from your point of view and from the law's point of view, it was a non-event. This pro se motion was a nullity that no one should have considered, and in fact, the prosecutor shouldn't have changed the state's position based on something that didn't exist because the person was represented. So if we assume that the predicate for this is a motion that no one should have considered anyway, why should your client get any relief? Because your argument seems to be, once the motion was filed and the state changed its position, your client is entitled to some type of relief. So it all goes back to a motion that you admit had no force or effect.
And it didn't have any. His request was a legal nullity. And what it should have happened, as Your Honor has just noted, is the prosecution should have disregarded it, ignored it, and the court should have at that time sentenced him. But the state didn't make that decision at that time. In the transcript of December 1st sentencing, it was the state that suggested that sentencing go forward on the charge for which a conviction had been obtained at trial. The court itself, the trial judge, I think correctly, should have wanted to and should have rescheduled the whole thing and therefore not created this situation. However, the court followed the state's request. And at that point in time, Your Honor, the state had repudiated the contract. I take that language from my opposing counsel's brief and also from his definition of what repudiation is. He has said that my client repudiated the agreement.
Did either your client or the prosecutor ask the court to determine whether there had been a breach of the plea agreement?
I argued that the plea agreement was breached, and I think that implicitly that's a request for a determination at the time of the December 1st, 2006 hearing. I joined my client then and there in requesting withdrawal once trial counsel below for the state had made the five-year recommendation.
Is there a ruling by the judge as to whether there was a breach of the plea agreement either by your client or by the prosecutor?
There was no specific ruling that said that I recall in the record, Your Honor. What there was again, an implicit denial. Well, there was a ruling that there would be a resentencing.
Well, should there be a ruling? I mean, is it up to you to decide as defense counsel whether the state's lived up to its bargain, or is it up to the prosecutor to decide as the prosecutor whether the defendant has lived up to his bargain? Who should decide that?
Well, I think that I think it's obvious that both the defendant and then defense counsel requested withdrawal, and that Mr. Walther, at the time of the sentencing hearing, actually repudiated the contract again, and it essentially acted as if it didn't exist then. And then the court, finally, at that sentencing hearing, acted as well as if that contract or plea agreement did not exist by sentencing at that time. And as a result, I do believe that the court implicitly determined that the plea agreement was rescinded by all the parties involved, that the defendant sought out of it, that the state, once they heard that, perceived this to be manipulation by the defendant, and he thought, as a prosecutor would think, and said this person needs to receive more punishment than he has bargained for.
Well, help us articulate a rule of law, though. You're describing all of the confusion at what I'll call the middle stage.
Mm-hmm.
At the end, your client got exactly what was bargained for. Now, your argument has to be something like this. We made a bargain. There was a lot of confusion. We got a harsher sentence. Then it was fixed. Then my client got the sentence he bargained for. Notwithstanding the fact that he got the sentence he bargained for, he should get to withdraw his guilty plea because of the confusion in the middle. Because. Now what's the because? What's the rest of that?
Well, with respect, Your Honor, I don't fully accept Your Honor's perception of what the argument has to be. But I would be happy to...
Well, you know, just work with me on that.
Okay. I think that he is seeking what he has always sought in this case, and that is a trial. And the only point in time during the course of this case where he sought anything else was
when he pled guilty.
Immediately before the second, that's true, immediately before the second trial date, after he had testified to his innocence, and...
Well, but that seems like an indirect attack on the guilty plea. He seems to be capitalizing on what I've called the confusion to withdraw a guilty plea that he otherwise could not withdraw because he made a very comprehensive record that it was a knowing and intelligent waiver of his right to trial and that he was pleading guilty voluntarily.
But, Your Honor, here's the reason why I responded the last time to what you said, and that is that I don't think it was confusion that occurred on December 1st. I think that with respect to my opposing counsel at the time, trial counsel, I think it was a fit of emotional reaction to something that was occurring, and that he made an intentional decision which was clear on its face and not confusing. And
well,
that
the
is
only reason
he saw
I characterized it as confusing is because the record indicates that after this harsher sentence was imposed, the state reviewed something and then came back to the court and said, with detached reflection or after further review, the state has concluded it's bound by the original bargain. And therefore, the position the state took at sentencing, asking for a harsher sentence, is inconsistent with what we concede was our agreement. And therefore, we'd like him resentenced consistent with the agreement. So somehow that came about.
I wish they had said that in their letter, Your Honor, because he didn't really, the prosecutor never really admitted that there was any breach on his part and never really indicated that he was making a recommendation for a sentence. Basically, he said that the way we can fix this is just to do what was in the agreement. And he said at the far end of a memorandum, which was much longer, talking about how he had not violated the agreement and how Mr. Chavis was essentially manipulating the system, and an explanation of why he acted the way he did.
So by doing that, the rescission aspect was waived by the state at that point?
I believe the state waived its right to oppose the withdrawal of this plea when it treated the plea as if it was withdrawn at the December 1st sentencing and sought a, and in fact, its only obligation under the agreement was to make the recommendation. It's not like in Scarborough where there's a lot of question as what the obligations of the party were, where there were side agreements and oral agreements that were not memorialized. There's only two little pieces to this puzzle, and the state did not place its piece of the puzzle or its piece of the pie or agreement together with it. It simply and intentionally violated the agreement.
Well, tell us the rule you're advocating that we would apply in future cases. Is this simply up to the judge and there was some abuse of discretion, or do you want to characterize certain conduct by the state that would always result in the defendant being able to withdraw the guilty plea?
Your Honor, I believe that any time the state intentionally repudiates the agreement, and not that it's, and I want to make this absolutely clear, so I don't want to be referring to counsel below as committing grave prosecutorial misconduct, which is the standard that Scarborough talked about in terms of having specific, not specific performance, but rescission of the plea agreement. But I think that if there's a substantial and material breach that is intentionally done, that that would serve as a sufficient basis for the defense to be given, defendant to be given the right to elect which of the remedies would be appropriate. If it were to be otherwise, if it were to be that the that otherwise, then the state, by intentionally violating the agreement, would be able to get out of any agreement and put the persons in their original place, which might, on some occasions, be what the state seeks and what the defendant does not seek. But here, there's an intentional violation, an intentional withholding of performance in this contract, based upon, I believe, good faith prosecutorial thoughts as to why they would change that recommendation, but nevertheless, a violation of that agreement that's intentional, then that type of agreement should be, the defense should be given the right to withdraw from the agreement if they so seek. And in this particular case, the one thing I haven't spoke to about, and I realize I'm in my rebuttal time here, the one thing I haven't spoke about is that the one right that we really don't discuss that much here, and that is his right to a trial, which is the most serious and fundamental right that's discussed in the criminal justice system,
apart
as Your Honors know.
Apart from the sentence recommendation, is there any other basis to withdraw the plea?
There can be no other possible basis, because that's the only thing the state had to do, but no, there is no other basis, Your Honor.
There's no defect in the plea colloquy?
No, and I did not argue that, Your Honor, in my briefs. I know that counsel addressed that issue. Anyway, I will
very right. You have about 3.5 minutes.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Mr. Carroll.
May it please the Court. Good morning, Justice Holland, Justice Berger, Justice Ridgely. For the record, Kevin M. Carroll appearing on behalf of the states. The state agreed to drop charges and to make a certain sentencing recommendation in exchange for John Chavis pleading guilty to one count of robbery in the first degree. And I think a good point to start is, was there a plea agreement in this case? And clearly the answer is yes. The plea agreement called for Mr. Chavis to plead guilty to one count of robbery in the first degree, and for the state to dismiss the remaining charges and to make sentencing recommendations on the possession of a deadly weapon by person prohibited, conspiracy second charge, as well as the robbery first. There being a plea agreement, the question then becomes, was there a breach of that plea agreement? And I believe Justice Ridgely brought that up during Mr. Goff's opening remarks.
Well,
and
help us at the very beginning to understand why the state was concerned about this defendant's pro se motion when he had counsel. You know, years ago, our court said there's no right to hybrid representation. And if you look at cases that have been decided for decades, when someone's represented and they file a motion pro se, it's simply referred to their attorney. They're told they're represented. You either are pro se or you have an attorney, but there's no hybrid representation. It's hard for the court to understand why, when the state gets a pro se motion by someone who's represented by an attorney, it should give them any cause for concern.
I understand the court's question with that, and I think a good place to start off with is the state didn't receive the motion. The state had no notice of the motion until the day of
sentencing.
I understand
that, but the state, just like you're standing at the podium, mm-hmm. say, well, you know, we've got this pro se motion to withdraw the guilty plea. I'm sure your response immediately would be, well, that's irrelevant. He's got an attorney, and the attorney didn't file a motion. Let's proceed.
Yes, Your Honor. And that clearly is what's required under Criminal Rule 47. Mr. Chavis had not been granted leave to participate as co-counsel in this case. And the state submits, as Your Honor recognized, that any pro se filing at this point was the legal equivalent, it was a nullity. It was the legal equivalent of zero.
Well, did anyone tell Mr. Chavis that you filed I'm aware that there's this written pro se application, the court's not going to consider it unless you seek to represent yourself or provide good cause for other counsel to be appointed? Was anything done between the defendant and the trial judge on that?
Yeah, I don't believe there was. There certainly was nothing docketed from the prothonotary regarding that. I know in certain circumstances, the prothonotary may send out a letter to defense counsel informing them of the pro se filing. I know this court certainly doesn't. We see plenty of those with the electronic filing now. That wasn't done in this case, as far as I can tell. There was no notice about that. And when it was presented to the court, the issue is what to do with it. And the court decided that it would accept it. And as Mr. Goff recognized, there was no factual basis for the motion. Ultimately, the court denied the motion. And that was a wholly appropriate decision. The defendant bore the burden of proving a fair and just reason to allow him to withdraw the guilty plea. And that's under Rule 32. And he failed to do so here. The plea colloquy was substantial. Through the plea colloquy and the truth in sentencing form, he indicated that he wished to plead guilty, that no one had made any promises, that he was not threatened, that he understood his rights, he understood the charges and the penalties associated.
But what the record reflects is the state took the position, well, now that we've had to listen to your pro se motion, we're not going to recommend the sentence in the plea agreement. We're going to recommend a harsher sentence.
Your Honor, I believe the prosecutor made it clear at sentencing that if Mr. Chavis was allowed to proceed with his motion to withdraw, then the state was not bound by its plea agreement.
But that was a unilateral determination by the prosecutor, wasn't it?
Yeah, I don't believe it was, Your Honor, because...
Well, did the trial judge say that?
No, he didn't, Your Honor. But it was still left to the trial judge's discretion to allow Mr. Chavis to withdraw his guilty plea at that time.
Well, shouldn't the rule be that no one is out of the plea agreement obligations until the trial judge says so?
I think that it's certainly the clearest way of approaching this. And the state would submit that that rule is certainly
isn't that
sufficient.
The Third Circuit's rule in U.S. v. Williams that you cited?
Yes, Your Honor. It's pretty much that there is no unilateral decision on this. And I don't think the prosecutor was making a unilateral decision here. He was just stating a fact. If he's allowed to withdraw.
But he wound up being sentenced.
Excuse me, Your Honor?
He wound up being sentenced originally on the basis of the state's amended recommendation, correct?
Yeah, that would be correct, Your Honor, yes.
Well, it sounds as if what you're saying is that if we have a situation where it's unclear whether an existing plea agreement is still in force, then the state can act as if it's not in effect. And then if it turns out that the state wants to go back and reinstate it, the state is free to do so. Is that consistent with contract principles?
It wouldn't be, Your Honor, but the state's position is that not only do contract laws govern and contract principles govern these types of agreements, but there are also additional concerns to be taken into consideration here. And one of them, and it wasn't addressed by either party in the briefing here, and I'm reluctant to address on it, but I'd be happy to in supplemental filings, is concerned about double jeopardy violations here. And I'm sure the court can appreciate that it's certainly easier to make a downward departure from a sentencing recommendation rather than to make an upward departure once a defendant has been sentenced. Here the plea agreement did not contain any waiver of any double jeopardy claim.
Well, but I think opposing counsel is taking the position that the state got it both ways in this case, that there was arguably a withdrawal of the plea agreement by both sides in the sense that the defendant wanted to withdraw it and the state said, well, okay, if that's what you want, then, you know, we want you to be sentenced for even more time. And so at that point, arguably, the plea agreement had been rescinded by mutual agreement. But then the state changed its mind and said, well, let's go back and reinstate this plea agreement. And by what authority can the state take two sides of this argument and, you know, then just wait and see which one works out better?
Your Honor, I think it's consistent with the fact that the trial judge had the final say in terms of whether or not Mr. Chavis was allowed to withdraw his guilty plea. And until the court made a determination about that, as Justice Brewster recognized, it was not up to either the state or Mr. Chavis to rescind or withdraw from the plea agreement.
When did the court decide whether the guilty plea had been withdrawn or not?
There was a decision docketed on May 11th of 2007. That's docket item number 35. And it basically recognized that the plea was voluntarily, intelligently, and knowingly given.
But before that time, he had been sentenced, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Was there a particular urgency for why he had to be sentenced on the weapons charge and the conspiracy charge?
Not that I can see from the record, Your Honor, except for the fact that Mr. Chavis, I don't believe he was free at the time. I believe he was incarcerated, and he had been convicted of those two charges following a jury trial. So
and
there were considerable resources.
Did suggest to the trial judge, Your Honor, perhaps we should defer sentencing until this issue of the motion to withdraw the guilty plea is resolved because of its impact on sentencing recommendations?
That, Your Honor, that clearly would have been a clearer choice. Hindsight is always 20/20. And at the end of the day, the state submits that there was no prejudice, that, as Justice Holland recognized, Mr. Chavis got the benefit of his bargain for
it. And that goes back to Justice Berger's question. If the state did everything properly in concluding that it could disregard the plea agreement and ask for a higher sentence, and the higher sentence was imposed, and the state could have just walked away, he would have served a higher sentence. But that's not what happened. The state came back and said, you know, and we really should honor that original agreement. So if everything the state did in disregarding the agreement and asking for a higher sentence was correct, what was the basis for coming back to the court and saying, let's go back to the original agreement? And as Justice Berger asked, is this something that should be exclusively in the state's control on whether it wants to come back or not?
If I may take the second question first, I don't think that's necessarily the approach. Again, Rule 32 gives the trial judge discretion to make the final determination. And here, in this case, Your Honor, I believe it's important to recognize the fact that the plea agreement called for two independent acts on the part of the state here. One was to make the sentencing recommendation, and two, to dismiss the remaining charges against Mr. Chavis. And the dismissal of the charges was completed. That was done when, at sentencing, the calendar deputy stood up and entered nulli prosequi on the charges.
Which sentencing?
That would be on the December 1st sentencing, Your Honor. There was a nulli prosequi entered. At the time of the plea colloquy on September 26th, 2006. The state entered nulli prosequi, indicated that Mr. Chavis was pleading guilty. The court conducted the colloquy, found that the waiver and that the colloquy was sufficient, and found that Mr. Chavis had, in fact, waived his right to trial and all the rights by pleading guilty. I don't know if that answers Your Honor's question.
No, my question, I'll try it again, is what's the basis for the state coming back? After it got the higher sentence, what was the basis for the state coming back to the court and saying, even though we got the higher sentence that we asked for, we think we should vacate that sentence and go back to the plea agreement?
Your Honor, I believe it was a reflection and review of the pro se filing by Mr. Chavis. That was the predicate that brought around the prosecutor's change recommendation, everything like that. I'm reluctant to call it a change recommendation. It was just a conditional statement by the prosecutor. If Mr. Chavis is permitted to withdraw his guilty plea,
that's not the change I'm talking about. I'm talking about once the state had the higher sentence imposed, why did it come back and ask for a lesser sentence?
I think, Your Honor, again, it's by that time the state had an opportunity to review not only what Mr. Chavis had filed, but what Mr. Goff had filed in response to the court's order asking for the parties to respond to the motion.
Was it to correct an illegal sentence?
I don't know if it was to correct an illegal sentence, Your Honor. I believe it was, there were steps to realize the bargain for exchange by both parties here. And once the prosecutor had an opportunity to review in a meaningful manner what both Mr. Chavis and Mr. Goff had filed, the prosecutor determined that there was no basis for the motion to withdraw.
Well, another possible way of looking at the situation would be that after the state responded to the motion to withdraw at sentencing by saying, okay, if that's the way it's going to be, give him a greater sentence, and in fact prevailed on that, that the state became concerned that there would be an appeal, at which point that sentence would be reversed, and that at that point the defendant would be in a position to say, okay, the whole plea agreement is out the window, I want a trial. So the state decided it would be better to seek the reinstatement of the plea agreement. And if we assume that perhaps that was the thinking that went into the second step of the process here, then it gets me back to my original concern, which is that it would appear that the state was able to make a choice here of, on the one hand, deciding that it would agree to a withdrawal of the guilty plea and asking for the greater sentence, and then later deciding, no, we really want to reinstate that that plea agreement. And by what authority is the state entitled to choose which of those two results it prefers?
I understand the court's concern with that, and if I'm not answering it, please let me know. But I believe that this whole situation came about when Mr. Chavis filed his letter. That was a catalyst for the prosecutor's response here. And in the state's view, the state was the aggrieved party here, because Mr. Chavis sought to withdraw from his plea agreement. The plea agreement called for just one thing for Mr. Chavis, and that was for him to plead guilty to robbery in the first degree. When he sought to withdraw his guilty plea, there are a couple things that either happened. One, we had a breach, but as I indicated here, there was a legal nullity, you know, because the court should not have accepted the pro se filing. Two, and this is what I address in the supplemental memoranda, is that we had a violation of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing. And that covenant requires parties to any contract to refrain from unreasonable and arbitrary conduct which frustrates the purpose of
that agreement. Is the record absolutely clear that the court accepted the pro se filing? And my reading of the record is that we had this pro se motion to withdraw that was a nullity. And then the state took the position that if that was going to be considered, it was going to ask for a higher sentence. And at that point, Mr. Goff, the defendant's attorney, said, well, if the state's going to do that, then I join or I file a motion to withdraw. So at that point in time, there was really a pro se motion to withdraw that was a nullity, and then a motion by the attorney for the defendant to withdraw.
Your Honor, I'll refer the court to appendix page A27 of the appellant's opening brief, and that it's on transcript page 8, and the court inquires of Mr. Goff, would you discuss with Mr. Chavis and ask him whether he would prefer a sentence and handle this as a Rule 61 post-conviction application? Mr. Goff indicates he wants to withdraw his guilty plea, is what he's saying. At that point, Your Honor, there had been no application by Mr. Goff to withdraw the guilty plea or join in the application. And it appears that the basis for the court's consideration of the motion was Mr. Chavis's own filing. It was his own letter to the court. And again, I bring to the court's attention that the first time the state had any indication about this was at the December 1st, 2006 sentencing hearing, when the trial prosecutor was made aware of this. If the court has no further questions.
The pro se filing, did that filing complain of the conduct of defense counsel, the adequacy of representation, anything along those lines?
Your Honor, the motion to withdraw the guilty plea, and I included that as at page B1 of the appellee's answering brief, the appendix of the appellee's answering brief, indicated that Mr. Chavis was badgered into the plea agreement, that he never wanted the plea, that his defense attorney told him that he would lose. That Mr. Chavis didn't understand his rights, that he had a learning disability, and that no attorney-client relationship existed between Mr. Goff and Mr. Chavis, because Mr. Chavis only saw Mr. Goff on a few occasions.
Were all of those occasions. Allegations ruled upon by the trial judge ultimately?
I believe that the ruling was encompassed in the court's finding that the plea was knowing, intelligently, and voluntarily given. I refer the court to not only the colloquy, but also the truth in sentencing form, wherein, in addition to everything else indicated on that, Mr. Chavis indicated that he was happy with Mr. Goff's representation. He checked the box for that in his own handwriting and then signed off on that. And absent clear and convincing evidence to the contrary, he's bound by his representation to the court in both the plea and the truth in sentencing form.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Yes.
I
Just a couple of things that I want to clarify what our position is with regard to some of the facts. I think that at various points in the transcript of the December 1st, 2006 sentence hearing, I indicated that by the trial prosecutor's decision to withhold the one-year recommendation and make a five-year recommendation, that he had supplied a legal basis, and that I argued at that point that Chavis should be permitted to withdraw his plea. I believe that that forms an actual motion at that time to do that. The other thing I would note is that my worthy opposing counsel indicated that a nolle prosequi was entered on September 26th, the day of the plea. I will indicate, as an officer of the court, that nolle prosequis are not entered until sentencing takes place. Otherwise, you won't be able to try the case afterwards. Indeed, there was a trial that was out there that needed to be decided on the various charges that were not filed. And finally, with regard to the question posed to my opposing counsel concerning whether the judge below ruled on the allegations of what amounts to ineffective assistance or attorney coercion, there was no such ruling on that issue. I think probably because that is not usually dealt with at that stage of the proceedings.
So the only basis for the motion to withdraw that was ruled upon by the Superior Court was the one that you were arguing with.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Goff. Mr. Carroll, the court appreciates your arguments. We'll take this matter under advisement and we'll also take a brief recess.